Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center and an internationally recognized expert in colorectal cancer. Dr. Miller is the Director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Program, and he's also the author of Choices in Breast Cancer Treatment. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ken welcomes Dr. William Sledge. Dr. Sledge is the George D. and Esther S. Gross Professor of Psychiatry at Yale University, and he joins us this evening to discuss coping mechanisms for patients diagnosed with cancer.
Let's start off by talking about cancer and the perception that I think has been the case for many years that it's a death sentence. Which I don't think is true. And, you know, let's talk a little bit about sort of that initial, when people find out they have cancer, what's your experience about what goes, about their experience?
Well, I think it is true that it's a frightening moment in a person's life. And one of the great things that we can do is reassure them with the outstanding data we have on the progress we have in some illnesses and make sure that they understand that. The best antidote to fear is knowledge and information, and patients and their families should be encouraged to ask. It's sometimes hard to do when you're worried and scared about what the future is. You kind of don't want to know things. But and physicians and the people working in support of the physicians also need to be encouraging of that asking, and knowledge is the way out of this, and as well as the reassurance of family and friends and practitioners.
Let me ask you a question related. We'll talk about statistics for a second. You know, some we have information. We could actually say to a patient, well, there's a 59% or a 72%, or we could give it. We could give a number. What's your own perspective on the, is that useful? Is it harmful? Is it good?
Oh, I think it's very helpful. And probably what's even more helpful is some connection to somebody who's been through the illness, similar to the patient, and to talk to them about their experience. And that's why survivor groups are so critical in this equation. And, of course, you know, survivorship now starts the day you get the diagnosis, and that's appropriate given the effectiveness of our treatments, but it also is helpful in getting that bit of knowledge and that bit of experience into the mix. And there's nothing like talking to somebody who's been through it, who's had the same illness, and who's come out on the good side of it. And it's enormously reassuring.
Well, you know, we'll skip ahead a little bit, but I know that you're involved with a study now looking at peers.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we're looking at a variety of how people respond to chronic illness, and we've discovered over and over again that in a number of different chronic illnesses, the sufferers of the illness get a lot of benefit from helping others who suffer as well. And so this kind of altruism, medical altruism, if you want to call it that, has intrigued us about how it works. And so we've extended our look to the people who volunteer for survivor programs, and we're trying to understand better how they experience the benefit to them of helping other people.
So it's sort of fascinating that we started out by saying that the patients, the newly diagnosed patients, right, get a lot out of it, but so do the other people.
Absolutely. There's no question about it that it works in some way that we don't fully understand, but it works to help others, to give back to them, to be assistance to them, is enormously invigorating and somehow helps restore people to their image of themselves before they got sick.
Which is wonderful. What are the phases that you would help us identify for people that are just receiving that news that they have cancer?
Yep. Well, I think there are several phases. The first one is always shock and fear, worry, a frightful response of imagining and thinking and fearing the worst. And that's a particularly dangerous phase because you want to not know anything, and you kind of go into a state of resistance to that knowledge and to finding out about it, and you go into a kind of denial, a bad kind of denial that keeps you from knowing the facts. And so that's a critical time for everybody to try hard to learn as much as they can, to not become too caught up in resisting the knowledge. And then as one gets familiar with the people involved and maybe talks to somebody who's been through it and understands more of the facts and figures, you get into a stage of a kind of engagement with the problem where you either, you adopt a strategy. And the strategy, hopefully, is one that you're going to fight it and you're going to do everything you can on your side to reduce the risk factors, and you're going to cooperate with the caregivers and have a chance at beating it. And then as one gets more maturely involved in it, I mean by mature, you get experience and you know more about it, then you start creating the life that you have before you. It may be back to the way you were and with monitoring and surveillance, or you may have to adjust to some kind of loss of function, or you may have to adjust to an illness that's going to be hard to make go away.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. You know, you talked about people sort of drawing back, and there's some denial. Is that a backward step, or is it, or how do you look at it?
Well, it's an inevitable step, and I think denial is a complex mental mechanism. It has a good side. It protects you from knowing things or experiencing things you're not ready and able to know, and in that sense, it's something that, you know, we should respect and not try to bull our way through. On the other hand, there's a bad kind of denial, which keeps you from knowing the things you need to know to recover and take control of your life and your circumstance. And so the practitioners have to be careful to make the distinction between these kinds of denials and help people maintain a certain ability, not tell them too much, not tell them things they're not able to hear, not try to force them, but on the other hand, gently urge them to learn more, to understand more, to appreciate the facts, the details, and the reality of what they're facing.
You know, there's people listening to the show who've been diagnosed recently or have been through the cancer experience before. Let's focus on those who are recently diagnosed. What are some ways to manage that news?
Well, I think the one is to have a good, trusting relationship with the people taking care of you, to engage them, to ask them questions when you have questions. There are always questions, and there are things that you're told initially when you hear the bad news that you don't remember, you don't understand, you have to keep coming back to, and you have to just keep plugging away at understanding it. The other is to talk to your family and your friends, to be open about it. You don't have to go around proclaiming it, of course, but to not let yourself get caught up. Sometimes cancer has, like some mental illnesses, a kind of stigma associated with it, and people feel ashamed that they have this illness, and they feel they can't talk about it to others, and they can't speak to their best friends or their family about it. And that's a state of mind that inevitably ends up, well, not inevitably, but frequently ends up putting people in a feeling of being isolated and kind of cut off from the natural supports. So everybody needs to work on maintaining those natural supports of family, friends, professional practitioners, and looking out particularly for the emergence of depression, a very common sequelae of any kind of chronic illness, but particularly cancer.
So let me ask you about this. You know, as you were saying, that a person just diagnosed may not be willing or want to talk to their family or to a friend.
Right.
So in a sense, maybe fill in the blank. You know, they, I don't want to talk to my family because, what would be the reason?
Well, they, because they're afraid. They're afraid of being a burden. They're afraid of how their family is going to react. People fear the worst, which is an early death and a painful death or a burdensome death. But in fact, our knowledge and technology is very much ahead of that. It doesn't mean that we can always cure cancer, and it doesn't mean that we can always prevent death and early death, but we've made such great progress on it that that kind of response is the first response is usually not really realistic. And what is more realistic is facing the fact that you've got an illness that's going to require an intensive kind of treatment for a while that's going to be burdensome and troublesome, but one that which you'll likely come through with some element of success, if not a major element of success. And so the focus really needs to get away from the fearful, unrealistic part of it and focus on the realistic part of dealing with some time off from work, some discomfort of maybe chemotherapy or radiotherapy, and forging an adaptive response to that.
Let me ask you also about, you know, again, patients may be hesitant to tell their doctors. Say, geez, you know, I'm worried, I'm concerned, I'm afraid. And they would say, I don't want to talk to my doctor because, again, what would be their reasons?
Well, they're afraid of what they might find out.
Okay.
And they're afraid that what they might find out is they've got some awful illness. And this is a very understandable and natural human response. I mean, we all put off facing possibly bad news. It's just human nature, and that's the way we are. And for the most part, it's not so bad to do that. But when you're talking about something that can be treated in early stages and more effectively, then you don't want to have that putting off things. You want to participate. People who have a family history of cancer should be assiduous, regular, and assertive about all the different kind of screening tests and approaches available to surveil their potential for getting the illness early on. The earlier, typically, the earlier it's diagnosed, the better your chances of defeating it.
You mentioned depression, and I think for the listening audience, what does depression look like to a family member who's sort of watching it?
Well, depression is a complex kind of idea. Depression is a natural feeling state that we all experience. We call it sadness or depression. It's not necessarily an illness, but when we talk about depression as an illness, then we've got major interferences with function. People who are depressed as an illness are very pessimistic, irritable, have trouble sleeping, lose weight, and have trouble concentrating. And they have this feeling of gloomy sadness that permeates everything, and they feel very pessimistic and cannot see any future in the bright side. So depression associated with any illness always complicates the illness and makes it harder to recover from the illness and harder to get the proper treatment. So depression is like a risk factor. It ought to be treated aggressively, and we shouldn't let depression run. It's kind of like thinking of it as like smoking. If you're smoking and you have cancer, you need to stop smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And if you find out you've got cancer and you get depressed, you need to take care of the depression. It'll make your recovery much more effective and much more likely.
Well, we're going to come back to that in a couple minutes. We're going to take a break, in fact, for a medical minute. Then we'll return to talk more with Dr. William Sledge, who is a professor of psychiatry and active in the psychosocial support program here at the Cancer Center.
It's estimated that over 2 million men in the U.S. are currently living with prostate cancer. 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from this disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using two simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to experimental medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm joined by Dr. William Sledge to discuss methods of coping with the diagnosis of cancer. William, we were just talking about depression a couple minutes ago, but in terms of treatment and success rates in treating depression, what can you tell us about that?
Well, the success rates are pretty good. We have two major approaches to treating depression, and they typically should be combined. They're better off combined. They both do better if they're combined with each other. One is medication, and we have a variety of medications. Our science is developing rapidly about the specificity and the ability to be able to figure out exactly who should get what kind of medication. But right now, it's kind of trial and error. We have to try one, see how it works. If that doesn't work, we move to another kind. The other kind of treatment, though, that's very effective is psychotherapy, and there are different versions of it, and there's more than two, but they all work pretty well in the hands of skillful practitioners who know how to do it. And these forms of treatment can be considered brief treatment, which they go on for a limited number of sessions, 10, 12 or so, or an ongoing treatment of a supportive nature that is more open-ended. But the combination of those two together are very effective for treating most kinds of depressions, particularly depressions that are precipitated by the experience of having cancer.
I mean, my own experience as a clinician is that, you know, I think most of us as people, and certainly people going through the cancer experience, I think many or most have some experience with depression. Is that your feeling as well?
It's sometimes hard to distinguish distress from depression, but there is virtually no way to have cancer and not have something like depression and anxiety or worry and disturbance. And that's completely normal. And it doesn't necessarily by itself require treatment. It should be considered something that requires treatment when it persists, when it's more unrelenting, when it begins to interfere with decision making, interfere with normal function, where you can't sleep, where you're thinking all the time about it, when others get irritable and unable to carry out your normal, everyday kind of functions, then you need to step back and say, well, maybe I need some professional help with this.
Now, something that I think you've got a lot of expertise on just in your career and your research is differences in coping strategies as we age. What have you seen in terms of young adults, older adults?
Yeah. Well, people are more alike across the age spectrum than they are different, but obviously, according to your age, you have different ideas about what's ahead of you. And the older you are, the less likely you are to feel like you've got something undone that has to be done, and you're less likely to have people who are dependent on you than you have to worry about. So one of the major issues is do you have people that you support and dependent on you, and if you're going to be sick and disabled for a while, that's obviously a big worry and a concern. The presence of family makes a lot of difference in the kind of family. Young people, really young people, children, have a hard time really understanding what the illness is, and they tend not to be as maybe upset about it as older people who can really think about the prospects of it and understand it. Young people tend to be resilient and have a great capacity to put off and not worry too much about the consequences. But when you're in that kind of middle period where you've got young children and a family to support and people dependent on you, then, of course, that's the hardest time.
I mean, let's look at the flip side, which is the positive outlook, optimism. Are those what effect does that have on the process for both patients and their caregivers?
Right. Well, it's a good question. And the science on this issue is mixed. We all think that being optimistic makes a difference. The science of that is it's not so clear that it really makes a difference. Clearly, being optimistic and being in charge of your circumstances makes it easier for everybody to help you and take care of you and work with you. And usually the person who does feel that they're going to fight it and win out has a more positive experience as an experience throughout the course of the illness. What's not clear is whether survival is any different, frankly. So you can't necessarily control, though, how you feel. You can't make yourself be optimistic mm-hmm. when you're not. And so if you have this experience and you feel very pessimistic and you're having trouble, you can't just make yourself be positive, and that's when you might need some help, either from family, friends, or professionally if that's not enough.
Yeah, it's a good point because sometimes we feel like, you know, telling a friend, a relative, oh, just, you know, shake yourself out of it and and move on. And I guess that's difficult to do.
It is very difficult to do, and it's usually not very good advice.
Is acceptance a part of moving on, of beyond treatment?
Well, acceptance is a very interesting concept. If acceptance means that you appreciate the reality of what you're going through and you make an adjustment, then that's clearly a good thing. But if acceptance means a kind of passivity of giving up, that's probably not a good thing. So acceptance from the point of view of being realistic and understanding what kind of limits you may or may not have presently and in the future, that's good. That helps everybody make good decisions, make the right decisions for themselves. But if it's just simply, quote, giving up, that's not such a good thing. It's a demoralizing thing, mm-hmm. and demoralizing for the sufferer, demoralizing for those around them as well.
Yeah, when people are when our patients, cancer survivors, are finishing treatment and going back to what we call normal life or life as the regular day to day life, what are some of the issues that they face, and what are some tips for them?
Well, I think the some of the issues are what do you tell people about your illness and how much do you go into it? For the most part, strangers or people not close to you will ask you, but they don't really want to know, uh-huh. and you shouldn't be too offended if they seem to turn away or don't make eye contact after the first couple of sentences. And so you have to find a strategy for what you tell people about your circumstance. The other thing I think is important to get over any sense of shame or stigma about it and to feel comfortable with telling people what's been going on and how you've adapted. The other is my sense of people who have been through cancer, even those who've been very successful, have with them a residue of worry about recurrence. And in fact, that's completely understandable and appropriate. So they've got to have a way of handling that. And that's usually between them and their practitioner of a way of following up, of checking on early sign indicators in a regular, systematic way. and that needs to go forward and be accomplished and not be allowed to slip into that world of bad denial and dropped. The other thing is sometimes there are real limitations. There are surgeries that may have been transformative of one's body, where your body's different, and there may be consequences of some of the treatments that make you feel different for a long time, and you may look different. And so you've got to have an approach, and it's best to have a conscious, clear-headed approach to dealing with these differences. They may be differences in function, there may be differences in appearances, but they need to have a strategy for how to handle it.
As you know, and I'll share with the audience too, early in 2009, I'm going to be leaving Yale and moving on to a different position. But, you know, I've really had...
And we'll miss you, by the way.
Thank you.
Congratulations on that new position.
Thank you. But it's been very exciting sort of seeing what's happened in terms of what will be happening in terms of psychosocial support here at Yale. And can you tell us a little bit about what you're excited about?
Yeah. Well, I think the SMILO, the dedication of the university and the hospital to creating the SMILO Cancer Center and the citizens of Connecticut who've supported it is really a great thing for the region. And with that is going to come a much more comprehensive approach to cancer care. And that's going to entail not only the medical and biomedical approaches that we'll be able to bring to bear and the kind of people we'll be able to attract here to work here, but also the psychological and psychiatric side of things. And we're working hard now to come up with a plan for that. And as you know, there's a recruitment of a cancer center director, and that's underway. So we have to see exactly who that is going to be and what their approach is going to be, but the Department of Psychiatry is eager to be of assistance and help in all of this, and we're looking forward to it.
The team of healthcare professionals who are available for patients with cancer and their families includes who?
Well, that's an excellent question, and sometimes very puzzling to people. It should be a multidisciplinary approach, including people from many different disciplines, all of whom have something specific to offer. Medical social workers, nurses trained in psychiatric and oncology, psychologists, and then the medical practitioners who are psychiatrists, who are trained in particularly mental illness, but also specific aspects of the mind-body interface, how it has to do with cancer. And the best of circumstances, all those groups, including psychologists, are working together in a coordinated approach, each doing the thing that they do best and helping one another help other people.
If someone wants to seek resources through the Yale Cancer Center or through their oncology provider, how do they do it?
The best approach is through their provider, who will be able to. The services are changing, and whatever I tell you right now is probably not going to be up to date. But the best is through the various clinics and the survivor program that you're associated with is a good place to start.
Thank you. Yeah, and actually thank you for that little plug for the survivorship program. You've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. William Sledge. Thank you.
Thank you.
For joining us. Until next week is Dr. Ken Miller from the Yale Cancer Center wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have any questions for the doctors or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.